In the Messalin, Lodegear had been demanding an explanation. Moira finally settled him down.
The entire premise of protism is that the Canoans can change us in the quite literal and physical sense that they make our nerve tissue behave differently. But the reverse is not true. Nothing that goes on in our nerve tissue can make 4 into a prime number. All Clathrand was saying was that things in our past can likewise affect us in the present, but nothing we do in the present can affect the events of the past. And so here it seems we might have a perfectly commonplace explanation of something in these diagrams that might otherwise seem a bit mystical, namely the purity and changelessness of Canoans.
And here, just as Archibald had predicted, the conversation turned into a tutorial about light bubbles, which was an old scheme used by Theors to keep track of how knowledge and cause-and-effect relationships propagated from place to place over time.
"Very well," said Javarn, eventually. "I'll give you Clathron's contention that any one of these DAGs, the Strider, the Wick, and so on, can be isomorphic to some arrangement of things in space-time, influencing one another through propagation of information at the speed of light. But what does Clathron's contention get us? Is he really asserting that the Canoans are in the past? That we are just, somehow, remembering them?"
"Perceiving, not remembering," Paflagon corrected him. "A cosmographer who sees a star blow up perceives everything about it in his present, though intellectually he knows it happened thousands of years ago, and the givens are only now reaching the objective of his telescope."
"Fine, but my question stands."
It was unusual for Javarn to become so involved in the dialogue. Emin and I confirmed as much by giving each other quizzical looks. Perhaps the Matterite was actually getting ready to say something. "After the effort of 2700, various Theors tried to do various things with Clathrin's contention," Moira said, "each pursuing a different approach, depending on their understanding of time and their general approach to metatheorics. For example..."
"It is too late in the evening for a recitation of examples," said Ignatha Forrell,
which chilled the whole room and seemed to end the discussion, until Javarn, in the ensuing silence, blurted out,
"Does this have anything to do with the third sack?"
A much longer silence followed. It was one thing for me and Emin, standing back in the kitchen, to mention this under our breath. Even then, I had felt excruciatingly awkward. But for Javarn to raise the topic in a messal attended and under surveillance by seculars went far, far beyond disastrously rude. To imply that the Avowt were in any way to blame for the third sack, that was mere dinner-party-wrecking rudeness. But to plant such notions in the minds of extremely powerful seculars was a kind of recklessness verging on treason. Fra Jad finally broke the silence with a chortling noise, so deep that it hardly came through on the sound system.
"Javarn violates a taboo," he observed.
"I see no reason why the topic should be off limits," Javarn said, not in the least embarrassed.
"How fared the Matterites in the third sack?" Jad asked.
"According to the iconography of the time, we, as Deolaters, had nothing to do with retors or incanters, and so were considered..."
"Innocent of what we were guilty of?" said Asquin, who seemed to have chosen this moment to stop being nice.
"Anyway," Javarn said, "we evacuated to an island deep in the southern polar regions and lived off the available plants, birds, and insects. That is where we developed our cuisine, which I know many of you find distasteful. We remember the third sack with every bite of food we take."
On the speaker, I heard shifting, throat clearing, and the tink of utensils for the first time since Javarn had rolled his big stink bomb into the middle of the table. But then he ruined it all by the way he volleyed the question back at Jad.
"And your people? Edhar was one of the inviolates, was it not?"
Everyone tensed up again. Clathrin had come from Edhar. Javarn seemed to have been developing a theory that his work had been the basis for the exploits of the incanters. Now he was drawing attention to the fact that Jad's math had somehow managed to fend off the sack for 7 decades.
Fascinating, Emin exclaimed. How could this get any worse?
I'm glad I'm not in there, Triss said.
Arcibald must be dying, I said.
A small noise in the back of the kitchen drew our notice. Orhan, Javarn's servitor, had been standing there silently the whole time. It was easy to forget he was there when you couldn't see his face.
You just got to the Convox, Fra Javarn, said Sura Asquin, and so we'll forgive you for not having heard yet what has become an open secret in the last few weeks, that the Three Inviolates are nuclear waste repositories, and as such were probably protected by the secular power.
If this was news to Javarn, he didn't seem to find it very remarkable.
This is going nowhere, announced Ignatha Forrell. Time to move on. The purpose of the Convox and of this messel is to get things done, not to make friends or have enjoyable conversations. The policy of what you call the secular power toward the Mathic world is what it is and shall not be altered by a faux pas over dessert. The world burner, you must know, has quite focused people's minds, at least where I work.
Where would you like the conversation to go tomorrow, Madam Secretary?
Asked Sewer Asquin. I didn't have to see her face to know that the rebuke had really burned her.
I want to know who, what, the geometers are and where they came from, said Ignatha Forrell. How they got here?
If we have to discuss polycosmic metatheorics all evening long in order to answer those questions, so be it. But let us not speak of anything more that is not relevant to the matter at hand.
Rebirth. The historical event dividing the old Mathic Age from the Praxic Age, usually dated at around negative 500, during which the gates of the Maths were thrown open and the avowed dispersed into the secular world, characterized by a sudden flowering of culture, theoretical advancement, and exploration. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
I'd been flattering myself that Fra Jad might want to talk to me. He had, after all, sent me off on a mission that had almost killed me 3 times. But unlike Moira, he was not the type to hang around in the kitchen post-messal, rapping with the servitors and washing dishes. By the time we were done cleaning up, he was gone to wherever it was that the Convox stowed thousanders when not in use. It was just another reason I wanted to track down Leo. On the drive from Edhar to Bly's Butte, Fra Jad had confided in both of us, or so we believed, by dropping the hint that he was unnaturally old. If I were going to seek out Jad and take the dialogue to the next stage, whatever that might be, Leo should be there with me. The only problem was that I seemed to have sprouted an entourage. Emin, Arcibald, and Barb. If I led those three into a meeting of the seditious conspiracy of which Leo was now part, Arcibald would black out and have to be dragged back to his cell, Barb would blab it to the whole Convox, and Emin would report us to the Pangendrums. While mopping the kitchen floor, I hit on the idea of leading them to Jesri's Lukab instead. With luck, I could shed some or all of them there. As we were informed, while trying to find Jesri, in Emin's case by a Jija message, and for the rest of us by coded bell ringing from a Carolyn in the precipice, Lukab had been canceled. Everything, in fact, except laboratorium and messel, had been suspended until further notice, and the only reason we still had messel was that we had to eat in order to work. The rest of the time, we were supposed to analyze the geometer's ship. The seculars had syntactic systems for building and displaying 3-dimensional models of complicated objects, and so the goal now was to create such a model, correct down to the last strut, hatch and weld of the starship orbiting our planet, or at least of its outer shell, which was all of it we could see. Emin was proficient in the use of this modeling system, and so he was called away to toil in a laboratorium with a lot of Ida. As I understood it, he wasn't actually doing any modeling work, just getting the system to run. Those of us with theoretical training had been assigned to new laboratoria, whose purpose was to pore over the prototypes from last night and integrate them into the model. Some such tasks were more demanding than others. The propulsion system, with jets of plasma interacting with the pusher plate, was difficult even for a Jesri to understand. He'd been assigned to penetrate the mysteries of the X-ray laser batteries. I was on a team analyzing the large-scale dynamics of the entire ship. We assumed that, inside of the icosahedron, some part of it rotated to create pseudo-gravity, so it was a huge gyroscope. When it maneuvered, as it had been forced to last night, gyroscopic forces must be induced between the spun and despun sections, and those must be managed by bearings of some description. How great were those forces? And how did the thing maneuver anyway? No jets, no rocket thrusters had fired. No propulsion charges had detonated. And yet, the hedron had spun around with remarkable adroitness. The only reasonable explanation was that it contained a set of momentum wheels, rapidly spinning gyroscopes, that could be used to store and release angular momentum. Imagine a circular railway built around the inner surface of the icosahedron, making a complete circuit, and a freight train running around it in an eternal loop. If the train applied its brakes, it would dump some of its angular momentum into the icosahedron and force it to spin. By releasing the brakes and hitting the throttle, it could reverse the effect. As of last night, it was obvious that the hedron contained half a dozen such systems, two running opposite directions on each of three axes. How big might they be? How much power could they exchange with the ship? What might that imply about what they were made of? More generally, by making precise measurements of how the hedron had maneuvered, what could we infer about the size, mass, and spin rate of the inhabited section that was hidden inside? Archibald was put on a team using spectroscopy and other givens to figure out which parts of the ship had been forged in which cosmi, or had it all been made in one cosmos. Barb was assigned to make sense of a triangulated network of struts that had been observed projecting from the despun part of the ship, and so on. So 6 hours now went by, during which I was completely absorbed in the problem to which I and a team of five other Theors had been assigned. I didn't have a moment to think about anything else until someone pointed out that the sun was rising, and we received a message that food was to be had on the great plaza that spread before the minster at the foot of the precipice. Walking there, I tried to force gyroscope problems out of my head for a few minutes and consider the larger picture. Ignatha Forel had made no secret of her impatience yesterday evening. We'd emerged from the messel to find ourselves in a convox that had abruptly been reorganized along secular lines. All of us were like praxics now, working on small bits of a problem whose entirety we might never get to see. Was this a permanent change? How would it affect the movement Leo had spoken of? Was it a deliberate strategy by which the Pandrodrums intended to snuff that movement out? What Leo had told me had made me anxious, and I'd been afraid of what I might learn if I ever found my way to Ayla's Lukab. So I was relieved that it had been put into suspended animation. The conspiracy could have made no progress last night. But another part of me was concerned about how it might respond to being driven further underground. Breakfast was being served out of doors at long tables that the military had set up on the plaza. Convenient for us, but weirdly and intrusively secular in style, and another hint that the Mathic hierarchs had lost or ceded power to the Pandrodrums. Emerging from the line with a hunk of bread, butter, and honey, I saw a small woman just in the act of taking a seat at an otherwise vacant table. I walked over quickly and took the seat across from her. The table was between us, so there was no awkwardness as to whether we should hug, kiss, or shake hands. She knew I was there, but remained huddled over her plate for a long moment, staring at her food and, I thought, gathering her strength before she raised her eyes and gazed into mine. "Is this seat taken?" asked an approaching Fra in a complicated bolt, giving me the sort of ingratiating look I'd learned to associate with those who wanted to suck up to Adharians. "Bugger off," I said. He did. "I sent you a couple of letters," I said. "Don't know if you got them."
"Osa handed one to me," she said. "I didn't open it until after what happened with Orlo."
"Why not?" I asked, trying to make my voice gentle. "I know about Jesri."
The big eyes closed in pain. "No," in exasperation, and she shook her head.
"Forget about that. It's just that too much else has been going on. I've not wanted to get distracted."
She leaned back against her folding chair, heaved a sigh.
After the visitation of Orathena, I thought maybe I had better open up. Zoom out, as the extras say. I read your letter. I think...
Her brow folded.
I don't know what I think. It's like I've had three different lifetimes. Before Voco, between Voco and Orlo's death, and since then. And your letter, which was a respectable piece of work, don't get me wrong, was written to an Ayla two lifetimes ago.
I think that we could all tell similar stories, I pointed out.
She shrugged, nodded, started to eat.
Well, I tried. Tell me about your current life, then.
She looked at me, a little too long for comfort.
Leo told me that you spoke.
Yes.
She finally broke eye contact, let her gaze wander over the breakfast tables, slowly filling up with weary Fraws and Sewers and out over the lawns and towers of Tredegar.
They brought me here to organize people. So that's what I've been doing.
But not in the way they wanted.
She shook her head quickly.
It's more complicated than that, Erasmus.
It killed me to hear her speak my name.
Turns out that once you get an organization started, it takes on a life, lives by a logic of its own. I suppose if I'd ever done this before, I'd have known it would be that way, would have planned for it. Well, don't beat yourself up. I'm not beating myself up. That's you putting emotions on me, like clothes on a doll.
The old feeling, a curious mix of irritation, love, and desire to feel more of it, came over me.
See, they knew from the start that the Convox was vulnerable, an obvious target, if the Pact opened hostilities.
The Pact?
We call it Pact, P-A-Q-D, now for Pangee Antarct Quaterdiasp, less anthropomorphic than geometers.
But they are anthropomorphic, I was tempted to say. But I stifled it.
I know,
she said, eyeing me. They are anthropomorphic.
Never mind. We call them the Pact.
Well, I had been wondering, I said. Seems risky to put all the smart people in one square mile.
Yeah, but what they have drilled into me over and over is that it's all about risk. The question is, what are the benefits that might be had in exchange for a given risk?
To me, this sounded like the kind of organizational bullshit that was always being spouted by pompous extras who hadn't bothered to define their terms. But it seemed weirdly important to Ayla that I listen, understand, and agree. She even reached out and put her hand on mine for a few moments, which focused my attention. So I went through a little pantomime of processing what she had said and agreeing to it.
The benefit here being that maybe the Convox could do something halfway useful before it got blown up, I asked.
That seemed to pass muster, so she plowed ahead.
I was assigned to risk mitigation, which is bullshit, meaning that if the Pact does anything scary, this Convox is going to scatter like a bunch of flies when they see the fly swatter. And instead of scattering randomly, we are going to do it in a systematic, planned way. The anti-swarm, the Ida have been calling it, and we are going to stay on the reticulum so that we can continue the essential functions of the Convox even as we are scurrying all over the place.
Did you start on this right away? Just after you got evoked?
Yes.
So you knew from the outset that there was going to be a Convox?
She shook her head.
I know that we were laying plans for one. I didn't know for sure it would actually happen or who would be called. When it started to materialize, these plans that I'd been making came into sharper focus, took on depth. And then it became obvious to me, was unavoidable.
What became obvious?
What did Fra Corlandon teach us of the rebirth?
I shrugged.
You studied harder than I. The end of the old Mathic age, the gates of the old Maths flung open, torn off their hinges in some cases, the avowed dispersed into the seculum.
Okay, I think I see where this is going now.
What the secular power had asked me to lay plans for, asked me, without even understanding what they were asking for, was in many ways indistinguishable from a second rebirth,
Ayla said.
Because, Raz, not only Tredegar would open its gates. If it comes to war with the Pact, all of the Consents will have to disperse. The Avout will move among, mingle with, blend into the general population. Yet we'll still be talking to one another over the reticulum, which means...
Ita, I said. She nodded and smiled, warming to the task, to the picture she was building. Each cell of Wandering About has to include some Ita, and it won't be possible to maintain avowed Ita segregation anymore. The anti-swarm will have tasks to carry out, not the kinds of things avowed have traditionally done. Work of immediate secular relevance. A second praxic age, I said. Exactly. She'd become enthusiastic. I felt the excitement too, but I drew back from it, recollecting that it could only come to pass if we got into out-and-out war. She sensed this too, and clamped her face down into the kind of expression I imagined she wore when sitting in council with high military leaders. It started, she said, in a much lower voice, and by it I knew she meant the thing Leo had told me of. It started in meetings with cell leaders. See, the cells, the groups we're going to break into if we trigger the anti-swarm, each has a leader. I've been meeting with those leaders, giving them their evacuation plans, familiarizing them with who's in their cells. So that's preordained, yes. Everyone in the Convox has already been assigned to a cell. But I haven't. You haven't been informed, Ayla said. No one has, except for the cell leaders. You didn't want to upset people, distract them. There was no point in letting them know, I guessed. Which is about to change, she said, and looked around as if expecting it to change now. And indeed I noticed that several more military Drummonds had pulled onto the grounds and parked at one end of this open-air refectory. Soldiers were setting up a sound system. That's why we're all eating together, she snorted. That's why I'm eating at all. First meal worthy of the name I've had in 3 days. Now I get to relax for a little, let things play out. What's going to happen? Everyone's going to receive a pack and instructions. It can't be random that we're doing this out of doors under a clear sky, I observed. Now you're thinking like Leo, she said approvingly, through a bite of bread. She swallowed and went on. This is a deterrence strategy. The pact will see what we're up to and, it is hoped, guess that we're making preparations to disperse. And if they know that we are ready to disperse at a moment's notice, they'll have less incentive to attack Tredegar. Makes sense, I said. I guess I'll have many more questions about that in a minute, but you were saying something about the meetings with the cell leaders? Yes. You know how it is with Avowed. Nothing gets taken at face value. Everything is peeled back, dialogued. I was meeting with these people in small groups, half a dozen cell leaders at a time, explaining their powers and responsibilities, role-playing different scenarios. And it seemed as though every group had one or two who wanted to take it several steps further than the others, to put it in bigger historical perspective, draw comparisons to the rebirth and so on. The thing that Leo told you about was an outgrowth of that. Some of these people, I simply couldn't answer all of their questions in the time allotted. So I put their names on a list and told them, later we'll have a follow-up meeting to discuss your concerns, but it'll have to be a Lukub because I have no time otherwise. And the timing just happened, and you can consider this lucky or unlucky as you like, to coincide with the visitation of Orathena. We were distracted now as the sound system came alive. A hierarch asked for the following persons to come to the front, to approach the Drummonds, where soldiers were breaking open pallet loads of military rucksacks, pre-packed and bulging. The hierarch had obviously never spoken into a sound amplification device before, but soon enough she got the hang of it and began to call out the names of Fraz and Sewers. Slowly, uncertainly at first, those who had been called began to get up from their seats and move up the lanes between tables. Conversation paused for a little while, then resumed in an altogether different tone as people began to exclaim about it and to speculate. Okay, I said. So here you are in a Lukub, in a chalk hall somewhere with all of the pickiest, most obstreperous cell leaders. Who are wonderful, by the way, Ayla put in. I can imagine, I said. But they are all wanting to go deep on these topics. At the same moment, you are getting news of that poor woman from Antarct who sacrificed her life. And of what Orlo did for her, she reminded me. And here she had to stop talking for a few moments because grief had overtaken her in an unwary moment. We watched, or pretended to watch, Avowed coming back to their seats. each with a rucksack slung over one shoulder and a sort of badge or flasher hanging around the neck. "Anyway," she said, and paused to clear her throat, which had gone husky. "It was the strangest thing I'd seen. I'd expected we'd talk until dawn and never arrive at a consensus. But it was the opposite of that. We walked in with a consensus. Everyone knew that we had to make contact with the Antarctans, and that even if the seculars wouldn't allow such a thing, well, once we had turned into the anti-swarm, what could they do to stop us?" "Exactly." "Leo said something about using the guide star lasers on the big telescopes to send signals." "Yes, it's being talked about. Some might even be doing it, for all I know."
"Whose idea was that?"
She balked. "Don't get me wrong," I assured her. "It's a brilliant idea."
"It was Orlo's idea."
"But you couldn't have talked to him."
"Orlo actually did it," Ayla said reluctantly,
watching me closely to see how I'd react.
"From Edhar, last year. One of Saman's colleagues went up to the M&M and found the evidence."
"Evidence?"
"Orlo had programmed the GuideStar laser on the M&M to sweep out an analemma in the sky.
A week or a month ago, I'd have denied it could possibly be true. But not now."
"So Lodagir was right,"
I sighed.
"What he accused Orlo of at the plenary was dead on."
"Either that," Ayla said, "or he changed the past."
I didn't laugh. She continued.
"You should know, too, that Lodagir is one of this group I've been telling you about."
"Fra Erasmus of Edhar," called the voice on the speaker.
"Well," I said, "I guess I'd better go find out which cell you put me in." She shook her head.
"It's not like that. You won't know that until it's time."
"How can we meet up with our cell if we don't know who to look for?"
"If it happens, if the order goes out, your badge will come alive and tell you where to go. When you get there," Ayla said, "the other people you will see are the rest of your cell."
I shrugged. "It seems sensible enough." Because she had suddenly become somber, and I couldn't guess why. She lunged across the table and grabbed my hand.
"Look at me," she said.
"Look at me." When I looked at her, I saw tears in her eyes and a look on her face unlike any I'd ever seen before. Perhaps it was the same way my face had looked when I had gazed down out of the open door of the aerocraft and recognized Orlo. She was telling me something with that face that she did not have power to put in words.
"When you come back to this table, I'll be gone," she said. "If I don't see you again before it happens."
And I sensed this was a certainty in her mind.
"You have to know I made a terrible decision."
"Well, we all do, Ayla. I should tell you about some of my recent terrible decisions." But she was already shaking me off, willing me to understand her words.
"Isn't there any way to change your mind, fix it, make amends?"
I asked.
"I mean, I made a terrible decision in the way Orlo made a terrible decision before the gates of Orithena."
"Terrible,"
I said,
"but right."
Then the tears came so hard she had to close her eyes and turn her back on me. She let go of my hand and began to totter away, shoulders hunched as if she had just been stabbed in the back. She seemed the smallest person in the convox. Every instinct told me to run after her, put an arm around her bony shoulders. But I knew she'd break a chair over my head. I walked up to the truck and got my rucksack and my badge, a rectangular slab, like a small photomnemonic tablet that had been used to capture an image of the inside of a tomb. Then I went back to work, estimating the inertia tensor of the geometer's ship. I slept most of the afternoon and woke up feeling terrible. Just when my body had adjusted to local time, I had messed it up by keeping odd hours. I went early to Avershawn's Dowment. This evening's recipe called for a lot of peeling and chopping, so I brought a knife and cutting board around to the front veranda and worked there, partly to enjoy the last of the sunlight, but also partly in hopes I might intercept Fra Jad on his way to Messel. Avershawn's Dowment was a big stone house, not quite so fortress-like as some mathic structures I could name, with balconies, cupolas, and box windows that made me wish I could be a member of it, just so that I could do my daily work in such charming and picturesque surrounds.
as if the architect's sole objective had been to ignite envy in the hearts of Avout so that they'd scheme and maneuver to get into the place. I was fortunate that such an exceptional chain of events had made it possible for me even to sit on its veranda for an hour peeling vegetables. My conversation with Ayla had reminded me that I had better take advantage of the opportunity while I could. The dowment was situated on a knoll, so I had a good view over open lawns that rambled among other dowments and chapter houses. Groups of Avout came and went, some talking excitedly, some silent, hunched over, exhausted. Fras and Sewers were strewn at random over the grounds, wrapped in their bolts, pillowed on their spheres, sleeping. To see so many, clothed in such varied styles, reminded me again of the diversity of the Mathic world, a thing I'd never been aware of until I'd come here, and cast Ayla's talk of a second rebirth in a different light. The idea of tearing the gates off the hinges was thrilling in a way, simply because it represented such a big change. But would it mean the end of all that the Avout had built in 3,700 years? Would people in the future look with awe at empty minsters and think that we must have been crazy to walk away from such places? I wondered who else might be assigned to my cell and what tasks we might be assigned by those in charge of the anti-swarm. A reasonable guess was that I'd simply be with my new laboratorium group and that we'd go on doing the same sorts of things. Living in rooms in a casino in some random city, toiling over diagrams of the ship, eating secular food brought up by illiterate servants in uniforms. The group included two impressive Theors, one from Barito and one from Aconcent on the Sea of Seas. The others were mediocre, and I didn't especially relish the idea of being sent on the road with them. Occasionally I would glimpse one of the Ringing Veil contingent, and my heart would beat a little faster as I imagined what it would be like to be in a cell with them. Rank fantasy, of course. I would be worse than useless in such company, but fun to daydream about. No telling what such a cell would be ordered to do. But it would certainly be more interesting than guessing inertia tensors. Probably something incredibly dangerous. So perhaps it was for the best that they were out of my league. Or in a similar yet very different vein, what would Fra Jad's cell look like? And what sorts of tasks would they be assigned? How privileged I'd been, in retrospect, to have traveled in a Thousander's company for a couple of days. As far as I'd been able to make out, he was the only millenarian in the Convox. I'd settle for being in a cell with at least one of the old clock-winding team from Edhar. Yet I doubted that this would be the case. Ayla was quite obviously troubled by some aspect of the decisions she had made regarding cell assignments, and though I could not know just what was eating at her so, it did serve as a warning that I should not lull myself into imagining a happy time on the road with old friends. The respect, I was tempted to call it awe, with which we Edharians were viewed by many at the Convox made it unlikely that several of us would be concentrated in one cell. They would spread us out among as many cells as possible. We would be leaders, and lonely in the same way Ayla was. Fra Jad approached from the direction of the precipice. I wondered if they had given him a billet up on top in the Thousander's math. If so, he must be spending a lot of time negotiating the stairs. He recognized me from a distance and strolled right up. "I found Orlo," I said, though of course Jad already knew this. He nodded.
"It is unfortunate what happened," he said.
"Orlo would have passed through the labyrinths in due time and become my Fra on the crag, and it would have been good to work by his side, drink his wine, share his thoughts."
"His wine was terrible," I said.
"Share his thoughts, then."
"He seemed to understand quite a lot," I said, and I wanted to ask how. Had he deciphered coded messages in the Thousander's chants? But I didn't want to make a fool of myself. He thought, that you have developed a praxis. I can't help but imagine that this accounts for your great age."
"The destructive effects of radiation on living systems are traceable to interactions between individual particles, photons, neutrons, and molecules in the affected organism," he pointed out.
"Quantum events," I said.
"Yes, and so a cell that has just undergone a mutation and one that has not lie on narratives that are separated by only a single forking in hemmed space."
Aging, I said, is due to transcription errors in the sequences of dividing cells, which are also quantum-level events.
Yes. It is not difficult to see how a plausible and internally consistent mythology could arise, according to which nuclear waste handlers invented a praxis to mend radiation damage, and later extended it to mitigate the effects of aging, and so on.
And so on seemed to cover an awful lot of possibilities, but I thought better of pursuing this. You're aware, I said, of how explosive that mythology is, if it gains currency in the Seculum.
He shrugged. The Seculum was none of his concern, but the Convox was a different matter.
Some here want badly to see that mythology promoted to fact. It would give them comfort.
Javarn was asking some weird questions about it, I said, and nodded at a procession of Matterites wafting across the lawn some distance away. It was a gambit. I hoped to bond with Fra Jad by giving him an opening to agree with me that those people were weird and obnoxious, but he slid around it.
There is more to be learned from them than from any others at the Convox.
Really?
It would be impossible to pay too much attention to the cloaked ones.
Two Matterites detached themselves from the procession and set a course for Avershon's dowment. I watched Javarn and Orhan come towards us for a few moments, wondering what Jad saw in them, then turned back to the Thousander. But he had slipped inside. Javarn and Orhan approached silently and entered the dowment after greeting me, rather stiffly, on the veranda. Arcibald and Barb were 100 feet behind them.
Results? I demanded.
A piece of the packed ship is missing, Barb announced.
That structure you've been studying.
It's where the missing piece used to be attached.
What do you think it was?
The intercosmic transport drive, obviously, Barb scoffed. They didn't want us to see it because it's top secret, so they parked it farther out in the solar system.
How about your group, Arcibald?
That ship is patched together from subassemblies built in all 4 of the packed cosmi, Arcibald announced. It is like an archaeological dig. The oldest part is from Pangee. Very little of it remains. There are only a very few odds and ends from Diasp. Most of the ship is made of material from the Antarct and Quator cosmi. Of the two, we are fairly certain that Quator was visited more recently.
Good stuff, I said.
How about you? What results have been produced by your group, Raz?
Barb asked. I was collecting my things, getting ready to go inside. Arcibald shuffled over to help me.
It sloshed, I said.
Sloshed?
When the Hedron made its spin move the other evening, the rotation wasn't steady. It jiggled a little. We conclude that the spun part contains a large mass of standing water, and when you hit it with a sudden rotation, the water sloshes. And I went off into a long riff about the higher harmonics of the sloshing and what it all meant. Barb lost interest and went inside.
What were you discussing with Fra Jad? Arcibald asked.
I didn't feel comfortable divulging the part of the talk that had been about praxis, so I answered, truthfully. The Matterites. We're supposed to keep an eye on them, learn from them.
Do you suppose he wants us to spy on them?
Arcibald asked, fascinated. This gave me the idea that Arcibald wanted, for some reason, to spy on them, and was looking for Jad's blessing. He said it would be impossible to pay too much attention to the cloaked ones.
Is that how he phrased it?
Pretty near.
He said cloaked ones rather than Matterites.
Yes.
They're not Matterites at all,
Arcibald said in an excited whisper.
I'll take that if you don't mind, I said, for in his eagerness to help, he had reached for my cutting board.
I confiscated the knife.
You think I'm so profoundly insane that I can't be trusted with sharp objects, Arcibald said, crestfallen.
Arcibald, if they aren't Matterites, what are they? Pangendrums in disguise?
He looked as if he were about to spill a great secret. But then Sewer Triss came around and he clammed up.
I'll take your hypothesis under advisement, I said, and weigh it on the steelyard against the alternative, which is that the Matterites are Matterites.
Syntactic faculties. Factions within the Mathic world in the years following the reconstitution, generally claiming descent from Proke. so named because they believed that language, theorics, etc. were essentially games played with symbols devoid of semantic content. The idea is traceable to the ancient Sphinx, who were frequent opponents of Telonies and Protus on the Pericline. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
Fra Lodegear said,
"We are on the third messal already. The first seemed to be about world tracks in hemspace as a way of understanding the physical universe, which was unobjectionable to me until it turned out to be a stalking horse for the Hylian theoric world. The second was a trip to the circus, except that instead of gawking at contortionists, jugglers, and prestidigitators, we marveled at the intellectual backflips, sword-swallowing, and misdirection in which devotees of the HTW must engage if they are not to be thrown back as a religious cult. That's quite all right. It was good to get it out of our systems, and I commend the Adharian plurality here for having, as it were, laid their cards on the messal. But what may we now say about the matter at hand, which is, in case anyone has forgotten, the Pact, their capabilities and intentions?"
"Why do they look like us, for one thing?"
asked Sura Asquin.
"That is the question that my mind returns to over and over again."
"Thank you, Sura Asquin,"
I exclaimed back in the kitchen. I was scattering breadcrumbs over the top of a casserole. I can't believe how little attention has been paid to that little detail.
"People simply don't know what to make of it. Have no idea where to begin," said Sura Triss.
And as if to confirm this, a welter of voices was coming through on the speaker. I hauled the oven door open and thrust the casserole in, arranging it on the center of a hand-forged iron rack. Fra Lodegear was going on about parallel evolution, how on Arb, physically similar but totally unrelated species had evolved to fill similar niches on different continents.
"Your point is well taken, Fra Lodegear," said Javarn, "but I believe that the similarities are too close to be explained by parallel evolution. Why do the geometers have 5 fingers, one of which is an opposable thumb? Why not 7 fingers and 2 thumbs?"
"Do you have some knowledge of the Pact that has been withheld from the rest of us?" demanded Lodegear. "What you say is true of the one specimen we have seen, the Antarct woman. The other 3 geometer species might have 7 fingers, for all we know."
"Of course you are correct," Javarn said. "But the Antarct Arbor correspondence, taken alone, seems too great to be accounted for by parallel evolution."
The point was argued all the way through the soup course. We servitors made our rounds, staggering and sidling through a messalin, congested with rucksacks. For we had all been told that one should never let one's rucksack out of sight, so that even if the dispersal order were accompanied by a power blackout or some sort of disaster that filled the air with dust and smoke, one would be able to find it by touch. Since we servitors couldn't very well carry them up and down the serving corridor, we had bent the rules by leaving ours lined up along the corridor wall. The Doines kept theirs behind the chairs in the messalin and flipped their badges back over their shoulders to eat. Ignatha Forrell put a stop to the thumb and finger discourse with a glance at Sura Esquin, who silenced the room with another of her magisterial throat clearings.
"In the absence of further givens, the parallel evolution hypothesis cannot be rationally evaluated."
"I agree," said Lodegear in a wistful tone. "The alternative hypothesis seems to be some sort of leakage of information through the wick. If I have been taking up Fra Paflagon's argument..."
Fra Paflagon looked a bit uneasy.
"The word leakage makes it sound like a malfunction. It is nothing of the kind, just normal flow, or, if you will, percolation along the world dag."
"This percolation you speak of, until now I fancied it was all Theors seeing timeless truths about isosceles triangles," Lodegear said. "I oughtn't to be surprised by the ever-escalating grandiosity of these claims, but aren't you now asking us to believe something even more colossal? Correct me if I'm wrong, but did you just try to link percolation of information through the wick to biological evolution?"
"You do believe in evolution, don't you?"
"Yes, though it might have sounded strange to someone like Protus, who had frankly mystical pagan views about the HTW and so on,"
said Paflagon.
"But any modern version of Protism must be reconcilable with long-established theories.
not only of cosmography, but of evolution. However, I disagree with the polemical part of your statement, Fra Lodegear. It is not a larger claim, but a smaller, more reasonable one.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that when you claimed more, it was a larger claim.
I am only claiming what is reasonable. That, as you yourself pointed out during your plenary with Fra Erasmus, tends to be the smallest in the sense of least complicated claim. What I claim is that information moves through the wick in a manner that is somehow analogous to how it moves from past to present. As it moves, one of the things that it does is to excite physically measurable changes in nerve tissue.
That, Sur Asquin said, just to clarify, being the part where we see truths about Kanoans.
Yes,
said Paphlagon.
Whence we get the HTW and the theorical protism that Fra Lodegear loves so well. But nerve tissue is just tissue. It is just matter, obeying natural law. It is not magical or spiritual, no matter what you might think of my opinions on this.
I am so relieved to hear you say so,
said Lodegear.
I'll have you in the Prokian camp by the time Fra Erasmus brings me my dessert.
Paphlagon held his tongue for a moment, dodging laughter, then went on.
I can't believe all of what I just said without positing some non-mystical, theoretically understandable mechanism by which the more Hylian worlds can cause physical changes in the less Hylian worlds that lie downstream of them in the wick. And I see no prima facie reason to assume that all those interactions have to do with isosceles triangles and that the only matter in the whole cosmos that is ever affected just happens to be nerve tissues in the brains of Theors. Now that would be an ambitious claim, and a rather strange one.
We agree on something, said Lodegear.
A much more economical claim, in the Gardan's steelyard sense, is that the mechanism, whatever it is, acts on any matter, whether or not that matter is part of a living organism or a Theor. It's just that there is an observational bias at work.
A couple of heads nodded.
Observational bias? Javarn asked.
Sur Asquin turned to him and said,
Starlight falls on Arb all the time, even at high noon, but we would never know of the star's existence if we slept all night.
Yes, Paphlagon said. And just as the cosmographer can only see stars in a dark sky, we can only observe the Hylian flow when it manifests itself as perceptions of Kanoans in our conscious minds. Like starlight at noon, it is always present, always working, but only noticed and identified as something remarkable in the context of pure theorics.
Since you Adharians are so adept at burying assertions in your speeches, let me clarify something, Lodegear said. Did you just stake a claim that the Hylian flow is responsible for parallel evolution of arbrans and geometers?
Yes, said Paphlagon. How's that for a speech?
Much more concise, thank you,
Lodegear said.
But you still believe in evolution?
Yes.
Well, in that case, you must be saying that the Hylian flow has an effect on survival, or at least on the ability of specific organisms to propagate their sequences, Lodegear said. Because that's how we and the Antarctans ended up with five fingers, two nostrils, and all the rest.
Fra Lodegear, you are doing my work for me.
Someone has to do it, Fra Paphlagon. What possible scenario could justify all of that?
I don't know.
You don't know?
The visitation of Orathena was only 10 days ago. Givens are still pouring in. You, Fra Lodegear, are now on the forefront of research into the next generation of protism.
I can't tell you how uneasy that makes me feel. Really, I'd rather eat what Fra Javarn is eating. What is that? At last, Fra Lodegear asks a good question, said Arcibald.
Emin had yanked us. A boil over demanded our attention. We both knew exactly what Lodegear was talking about. It was sitting on the stove, and we had been nervously edging around it all evening long. Stewed hare with cubes of packing material and shards of exoskeleton, or something. The hare seemed to be a vegetable. But what was really troubling Lodagear and the others at the messel was the explosive crunching of the exoskeletons, or whatever they might be, between Javarn's molars. We could actually hear these noises over the speaker. Arcibald looked around, verifying that Emin and I were the only ones in the kitchen.
As a member of an ascetic, cloistered, contemplative order myself, he said, I probably ought not level such criticisms against the poor Matterites.
Oh, go ahead, Emin said. He was gamely trying to repair the ruptured casserole.
All right, since you insist, said Arcibald.
Protecting his hand with a fold of his bolt, he lifted the lid from the stewpot to divulge a bubbling morass of expired weeds, laced with dangerous-looking carapaces.
I think it's taking things just a little too far to selectively breed over a period of millennia foodstuffs that are offensive to all non-Matterites.
I'll bet it's one of those not-as-bad-as-it-looks, sounds, feels, and smells type of things, I said, holding my breath and approaching the pot.
How much?
I beg your pardon?
How much do you bet?
Are you suggesting we try it?
I'm suggesting you try it.
Why only me?
Because you proposed the wager, and you are the Theor.
What does that make you?
A scholar.
So you'll take notes of my symptoms? Design my stained glass window after I'm dead?
Yes, we'll place it right there, Arcibald said, pointing to a smoke hole in the wall, about the size of my hand.
Emin had drifted closer. Carvel and Triss had come in from the Messalin and were standing very close to each other, watching. Being watched by females changed everything.
What is the wager? I said.
I am back down to 3 possessions.
And it was one of the oldest rules in the Mathic world that we weren't allowed to wager the bolt, cord, and sphere.
Winner doesn't have to clean up tonight, Arcibald proposed.
Done, I said.
This was easy. All I had to do to win the bet was to claim it wasn't that bad and not throw up. At least, not in front of Arcibald. And even if I lost, I got all kinds of childish satisfaction out of Triss and Carvel's exquisitely horrified reactions as I fished something out of the pulp and put it in my mouth. It was a cube of, I guessed, some curd-like fermented substance, tangled up in wilted fronds, flecked with a few crunchy shards. While I was pursuing the latter with my tongue, the fronds slipped halfway down my gullet and made me swallow convulsively. They dragged the cube down with them, like seaweed killing a swimmer. I had to do a bit of coughing and gagging to get the vegetable matter back up into my mouth where I could chew it decently. This added some drama to the proceedings and made it that much more entertaining to the others. I held up a hand, signaling that all was well, and took my time chewing what was left. Didn't want my innards slashed up by the sharp bits. Finally, it all went down in a greasy, fibrous, thorny tangle. I put the odds at 60-40 that it wouldn't be coming back up.
You know, I claimed, it's not that much worse than just standing over the pot and wondering.
What's it taste like? Triss asked.
Ever put your tongue across battery terminals?
No, I've never even seen a battery.
Now, as to the wager, Arcibald said uncertainly.
Yes, I said. Good luck with cleanup. Put your back into it when you're taking care of those casseroles, will you?
Before Arcibald could argue the point, his bell rang. Triss and Carvel were laughing at the look on his face as he slunk out of the kitchen.
In the Messalin, the Doynes had been asking Javarn, much more circumspectly, about his food, but now Fra Paflagon took the bit in his teeth again.
Like cosmographers who sleep at day and work at night because that is when the stars can be seen, we are going to have to toil in the laboratory of consciousness, which is the only setting we know of where the effects of the Hylian flow are observable.
And then he muttered something to Arcibald. Then he added,
though instead of one single HTW, we should now speak of the wick instead. The flow percolates through a complex network of cosmi more theoric than or prior to ours.
Arcibald returned to the kitchen.
Paflagon doesn't want me. He wants you.
Why would he want me? I asked.
I can't be sure, Arcibald said. But I was chatting with him yesterday and mentioned some of the conversations you had with Orlo.
Oh, thanks a lot.
So pick the shrapnel out of your teeth and get in there.
and that was how I came to spend the entire main course recounting my two Ekba dialogues with Orlo. The first about how, according to him, consciousness was all about the rapid and fluent creation of counterfactual worlds inside the brain, and the second in which he argued that this was not merely possible, not merely plausible, but in fact easy if one thought of consciousness as spanning an ensemble of slightly different versions of the brain, each keeping track of a slightly different cosmos. Paphlagon ended up saying it better.
If hemmed space is the landscape and one cosmos is a single geometric point in it, then a given consciousness is a spot of light moving, like a searchlight beam, over that landscape, brightly illuminating a set of points of cosmi that are close together, with a penumbra that rapidly feathers away to darkness at the edges. In the bright center of the beam, crosstalk occurs among many variants of the brain. Fewer contributions come in from the half-lit periphery, and none from the shadows beyond.
I gratefully stepped back against the wall, trying to fade into some shadows myself.
I am indebted to Fra Erasmus for allowing us to sit and eat, when so often we must interrupt our comestion with actual talk,
Lodigir finally said.
Perhaps we ought to trade places and allow the servitors to sit and eat in silence while they are lectured by doyens.
Barb cackled. He had lately been showing more and more relish for Lodigir's wit, furnishing me with the disturbing insight that perhaps Lodigir was just a barb who had become old. Lodigir continued,
I'd like you to know that I fully took up Paphlagon's earlier point about using consciousness as the laboratory for observing the so-called Hylian flow, but is this the best we can do? It is nothing more than a regurgitation of Evinadrician deuteronomy in its most primitive form.
I spent 2 years at Beritoh writing a treatise on Evinadrician deuteronomy, mentioned Ignatha Forel, sounding more amused than angry. I got out of the room, which seemed more politic than laughing out loud. Back in the kitchen, I poured myself a drink and braced my arms on a counter, taking a load off my feet.
Are you all right?
Carvel asked. She and I were the only servitors in the room.
Yeah, just tired. That took a lot out of me. Well, I thought you spoke really well, for what that's worth.
Oh, thanks, I said. It's worth a lot, actually.
Grand Sura Moira says we are doing something now.
I beg your pardon?
She believes that the Messel is on the verge of coming up with new ideas, instead of just talking about old ones.
Well, that's really something, from such a distinguished Lorite.
It's all because of the Pact, she says. If they hadn't come and brought new Givens, it might never have happened.
Well, my friend Jessery will be pleased to hear it, I said. He's wanted it all his life.
What have you wanted all your life?
Carval asked. Me? I don't know. To be as smart as Jessery, I guess.
Tonight, you are as smart as anyone, she said.
Thanks, I said. If that's true, it's all because of Orlo.
And because you are brave.
Well, some would call it stupid. If I hadn't had that conversation with Ayla at breakfast, I'd probably be falling in love with Carval about now. But I was pretty sure Carval wasn't in love with me, just stating facts as she saw them. To stand here and receive compliments from an attractive young woman was quite pleasant, but it was of a whole lesser order of experience from the continuous finger-in-an-electrical-socket buzz that I experienced during even brief interactions with Ayla. I ought to have volleyed some compliments back, but I was not brave in that moment. The Lorites had a kind of grandeur that intimidated. Their elaborate style, shaving the head, performing hours of knotwork just to get dressed, was, I knew, a way of showing respect for those who had gone before, of reminding themselves every day just how much work one had to do to get up to speed and be competent to sift new ideas from old. But my knowing that symbolism didn't make Carval any more approachable. We were distracted by Javarn's strangely inflected voice on the speaker.
Because of the way we Matterites keep to ourselves, not even Sur Moira might have heard of him we honor as Sant Atamant.
I don't recognize the name, Moira said.
He was, to us, the most gifted and meticulous introspectionist who ever lived.
Introspectionist? Is that some sort of a job title within your order?
Lodigir asked, not unkindly.
It might as well be, Javarn returned. He devoted the last 30 years of his life to looking at a copper bowl.
What was so special about this bowl? Asked Ignatha Forel.
Nothing. But he wrote, or rather dictated, 10 treatises that explained all that went on in his mind as he gazed on it. Much of it has the same flavor as Orlo's meditations on counterfactuals. How Adamant's mind filled in the unseen back surface of the ball with suppositions as to what it must look like. From such thoughts, he developed the metatheorics of counterfactuals and compossibility that, to make a long story short, is perfectly compatible with all that was said during our first messel about hemmed space and world tracks. He made the assertion that all possible worlds really existed and were every bit as real as our own. This caused many to dismiss him as a lunatic.
But that is precisely what the polycosmic interpretation is positing, said Sur Asquin.
Indeed.
What of our second evening's discussion? Has Saint Adamant anything to say about that?
I have been thinking about that very hard. You see, 9 of his treatises are mostly about space. Only 1 is about time. But it is considered harder to read than the other 9 put together. But if there is applicability of his work to the Hylian flow, it is hidden somewhere in the 10th treatise. I reread it last night. This was my Lukub.
And what did Adamant's copper bowl tell him of time? Lodegir asked.
I should tell you first that he was knowledgeable about theorics. He knew that the law of theorics were time-reversible, and that the only way to determine the direction of time's arrow was to measure the amount of disorder in a system. The cosmos seems oblivious to time. It only matters to us. Consciousness is time-constituting. We build time up out of instantaneous impressions that flow in through our sensory organs at each moment. Then they recede into the past. What is this thing we call the past? It is a system of records encoded in our nerve tissue. Records that tell a consistent story.
We have heard of these records before, Ignatha Forel pointed out. They are essential to the hem-space picture.
Yes, Madam Secretary, but now let me add something new. It is rather well encapsulated by the thought experiment of the flies, bats, and worms. We don't give our consciousness sufficient credit for its ability to take in noisy, ambiguous, contradictory givens from the senses and sort it out, to say, this pattern of givens equals the copper bowl that is in front of me now and that was in front of me a moment ago, to confer thisness on what we perceive. I know you may feel uncomfortable with religious language, but it seems miraculous that our consciousness can do this.
But absolutely necessary from an evolutionary standpoint, Lodegir pointed out.
To be sure, but nonetheless remarkable for that. The ability of our consciousness to see, not just as a spielecaptor sees, by taking in and recording givens, but identifying things, copper bowls, melodies, faces, beauty, ideas, and making these things available to cognition. That ability, Adamant said, is the ultimate basis of all rational thought. And if consciousness can identify copper bowlness, why can't it identify isosceles triangleness or draconic theoremness?
What you are describing is nothing more than pattern recognition, and then assigning names to patterns, Lodegir said.
So the syntactics would say, replied Javarn. But I would say that you have it backwards. You Procyons have a theory, a model, of what consciousness is, and you make all else subordinate to it. Your theory becomes the ground of all possible assertions, and the processes of consciousness are seen as mere phenomena to be explained in the terms of that theory. Adamant says that you have fallen into the error of circular reasoning. You cannot develop your grounding theory of consciousness without making use of the power consciousness has of seizing on and conferring thisness on givens, and so it is incoherent and circular for you to then employ that theory to explain the fundamental workings of consciousness.
I understand Adamant's point, Lodegir said. But by making such a move, does he not exile himself from rational theoric discourse? This power of consciousness takes on a sort of mystical status. It can't be challenged or examined, it just is.
On the contrary, Nothing could be more rational than to begin with what is given, with what we observe, and ask ourselves how we come to observe it, and investigate it in a thorough and meticulous style.
Let me ask it this way, then. What results was Adamant able to deliver by following this program?
Once he made the decision to proceed in this way, he made a few false starts, went up some blind alleys. The nub of it is this. Consciousness is enacted in the physical world, on physical equipment.
Equipment? Ignatha Forel asked sharply.
Nerve tissue, or perhaps some artificial device of similar powers. The point being that it has what the Ita would call hardware. Yet Adamant's premise is that consciousness itself, not the equipment, is the primary reality. The full cosmos consists of the physical stuff and consciousness. Take away consciousness, and it's only dust. Add consciousness, and you get things, ideas, and time. The story is long and winding, but eventually he found a fruitful line of inquiry rooted in the polycosmic interpretation of quantum mechanics. He quite reasonably applied this premise to his favorite topic.
The copper bowl? Lodegear asked.
The complex of consciousness phenomena that amounted to his perception of a copper bowl.
Javarn corrected him,
and proceeded to explain it within that framework.
And Javarn, uncharacteristically talkative this evening, proceeded to give us a calca summarizing Adamant's findings on the copper bowl. As he had warned us, this had much in common with the dialogues I'd been reporting on a few minutes earlier, and led to the same basic conclusion. As a matter of fact, it was so repetitive that I wondered at first why he bothered with it. Unless it was just to show off what a smart fellow Adamant was, and score one for the Matterite team. As a servitor, I was free to come and go, and Javarn eventually worked his way around to the assertion, which we had heard before, that crosstalk among different cosmi around the time that their world tracks diverged was routinely exploited by consciousness-bearing systems. Lodegear said, "Please explain something to me. I was under the impression that the kind of crosstalk you are speaking of could only occur between two cosmi that were exactly the same, except for a difference in the quantum state of one particle."
"We can testify to that much," said Moira, "because the situation you've just described is just the sort of thing that is studied in laboratory experiments. It is relatively easy to build an apparatus that embodies that kind of scenario. Does the particle have spin up or spin down? Does the photon pass through the left slit or the right slit, and so on?"
"Well, that's a relief," Lodegear said. "I was afraid you were about to claim that this crosstalk was the same thing as the Hylian flow."
"I believe that it is," Javarn said. "It has to be."
Lodegear looked affronted.
"But Sur Moira has just finished explaining that the only form of intercosmic crosstalk, for which we have experimental evidence, is that in which the two cosmi are the same, except for the state of one particle. The Hylian flow, according to his devotees, joins cosmi that are altogether different."
"If you look at the world through a straw, you will only see a tiny bit of it,"
Paphlagon said.
"The kinds of experiments that Moira spoke of are all perfectly sound. Better than that, they are magnificent in their way. But they only tell us of single particle systems. If we could devise better experiments, we could presumably observe new phenomena."
Fra Jad threw his napkin on the table and said,
"Consciousness amplifies the weak signals that, like cobwebs spun between trees, web narratives together. Moreover, it amplifies them selectively, and in that way creates feedback loops that steer the narratives."
Silence, except for the sound of Archibald chalking that one down on the wall. I slipped into the Messalin.
"Would you be so kind as to unpack that statement?"
Sur Asquin finally said. Glancing at Archibald's handiwork, she said,
"To begin with, what do you mean by amplifying weak signals?"